This is Washington Today for July 27th, 2021. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba with some of today's headlines. The January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol has, quote, never ended. That's according to at least one officer who testified today before the House January 6th Select Committee. We'll have more on that in a moment. The CDC recommends that some fully vaccinated people wear masks indoors in areas where the virus is circulating widely. Senators could be spending the weekend working on the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer made that announcement earlier. And a new poll shows many Republicans are uneasy about their party's future. The Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research shows fewer than half of Republicans, that's 41%, say they're optimistic about the GOP's future. Just 13% say they're very optimistic, and one-third, that's 33%, say they are pessimistic. Find more at apnews.com. First, we begin with a very emotional day on Capitol Hill. House Select Committee held a hearing to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol with testimony from four officers who were on the Hill that day. We begin with testimony from U.S. Capitol Police Sergeant Aquilino Gonell.
To be honest, I did not recognize my fellow citizens who stormed the Capitol on January 6th or the United States that they claim to represent. When I was 25 years old and then a sergeant in the Army, I had deployed to Iraq for Operation Iraqi Freedom. From time to time, I volunteered to travel on IED-infested roads to conduct supply missions for U.S. and allied forces and local Iraqi population as well. But on January 6th, for the first time, I was more afraid to work at the Capitol than my entire deployment to Iraq. In Iraq, we expected armed violence because we were in a war zone. But nothing in my experience in the Army or as a law enforcement officer prepared me for what we confronted on January 6th. The verbal assaults and disrespect we endured from the rioters were bad enough. I was falsely accused of betraying my oath, of choosing my paycheck over my loyalty to the U.S. Constitution. Even as I defended the very democratic process that protected everyone in the hostile crowd, while I was at the Lower West Terrace at the Capitol working with my fellow officers to prevent the breach and restore order, the rioters called me a traitor, a disgrace, and shouted that I, an Army veteran and a police officer, should be executed.
Sergeant Gonell also testified about his injuries and his family.
I vividly heard officers screaming in agony and pain just an arm length from me. I didn't know at that time, but that was Officer Hodges, and he's here today to testify. I, too, was being crushed by the rioters. I could feel myself losing oxygen and recall thinking to myself, this is how I'm going to die, defending this entrance. Many of the officers fighting alongside me were calling for shields because their shields had been stripped from them by the rioters. I was one of the few officers left with a shield, so I spent the majority of my time at the front of the line. I later find out that my wife and relatives were here in the U.S. and abroad. Were frantically calling and texting me from 2 p.m. onward because they were watching the turmoil on television. It was now until 4:26 p.m. after giving CPR to one of the rioters who breached the Capitol in an effort to save her life that I finally had a chance to let my own family know that I was alive.
Select Committee Chair, Mississippi Democrat, Representative Benny Thompson, opened the hearing discussing the reason for the hearing. Here's a portion of his remarks.
I'm talking about the peaceful transfer of power. 200 years ago, in 1801, the House of Representatives did one of its jobs laid out in the Constitution. After a deadlock in the Electoral College, this body cast 36 ballots and ultimately settled the contest for President of the United States. What followed was the first peaceful transfer of power in our country's history. We know that since then, our history has been far from perfect. We've been torn apart and brought back together. We've struggled across generations to make our country's great vision a reality for all Americans. We won victories and we've suffered failures. But the peaceful transfer of power has stood as the pillar of our democracy. It's one of those things we rely on, a safeguard that we hold close. Because as heated and angry and divided as we may be, whatever victories we celebrate or upheavals we endure, we can rest easy knowing that when the moment comes, our system guarantees that one party will hand the reins to another if that's the will of the people. And while our institutions endure, and while Joe Biden is the legitimately elected president of the United States, a peaceful transfer of power didn't happen this year. It did not happen. Let that sink in. Think about it. A violent mob was pointed toward the Capitol and told to win a trial by combat. Some descended on this city with clear plans to disrupt our democracy. One rioter said that they weren't there to commit violence, but that, I'm quoting, "We are just there to overthrow the government." I want to repeat that. I urge everyone to listen to those words and think about what they mean. We were just there to overthrow the government.
Representative Thompson also questioned U.S. Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn on being called racial slurs during the attack on the Capitol.
Officer Dunn, you talked about being called the N-word. You talked about being talked about like you've never heard before. And you talked about sharing comments from your other colleagues, as well as the seeing of the Confederate flag and other things carried through the Capitol. As an African-American law enforcement officer, can you give us, this committee and those who are watching, how you felt defending the Capitol on that day, being called that and seeing the symbols of the Confederacy going through the Capitol at the same time?
Yes, sir. Thank you for your question. To be frank, while the attack was happening, I didn't view it, and I wasn't able to process it as a racial attack. I was just trying to survive that day and get home. When I did have a moment to process it, I think that's in the rotunda where I became so emotional, because I was able to process everything that happened. And it was just so overwhelming, and it's so disheartening and disappointing that we live in a country with people like that, that attack you because of the color of your skin, just to hurt you. Those words are weapons. Thankfully, at the moment, it didn't hinder me from doing my job. But once I was able to process it, it hurt. It hurt just reading it now and just thinking about it, that people demonize you because of the color of your skin. When my blood is red, I'm an American citizen. I'm a police officer. I'm a peace officer. I'm here to defend this country, defend everybody in this building, not just the members, all the staff, guests, everybody. It just hurts that we have people in this country that result to that, regardless of your actions and what you desire to do and to make a difference out there. It's disheartening. So,
also testifying today, D.C. Metropolitan Police Officer Michael Fanone.
My body camera captured the violence of the crowd directed toward me during those very frightening moments. It's an important part of the record for this committee's investigation and for the country's understanding of how I was assaulted and nearly killed as the mob attacked the Capitol that day. And I hope that everyone will be able to watch it. The portions of the video I've seen remain extremely painful for me to watch at times, but it is essential that everyone understands what really happened that tragic day. During those moments, I remember thinking there was a very good chance I would be torn apart or shot to death with my own weapon. I thought of my four daughters who might lose their dad. I remain grateful that no member of Congress had to go through the violent assault that I experienced that day. During the assault, I thought about using my firearm on my attackers, but I knew that if I did, I would be quickly overwhelmed. And that, in their minds, would provide them with the justification for killing me. So I instead decided to appeal to any humanity they might have. I said as loud as I could manage, "I've got kids." Thankfully, some in the crowd stepped in and assisted me. Those few individuals protected me from a crowd and inched me toward the Capitol until my fellow officers could rescue me. I was carried back inside. What happened afterwards is much less vivid. I had been beaten unconscious and remained so for more than 4 minutes. I know that Jimmy helped to evacuate me from the building and drove me to MedStar Washington Hospital Center, despite suffering significant injuries himself. At the hospital, doctors told me that I had suffered a heart attack, and I was later diagnosed with a concussion, a traumatic brain injury, and post-traumatic stress disorder. As my physical injuries gradually subsided and the adrenaline that had stayed with me for weeks waned, I've been left with the psychological trauma and the emotional anxiety of having survived such a horrific event. And my children continue to deal with the trauma of nearly losing their dad that day. What makes the struggle harder and more painful is to know so many of my fellow citizens, including so many of the people I put my life at risk to defend, are downplaying or outright denying what happened. I feel like I went to hell and back to protect them and the people in this room. But too many are now telling me that hell doesn't exist, or that hell actually wasn't that bad. The indifference shown to my colleagues is disgraceful.
House January 6th Select Committee member, Wyoming Republican Representative Liz Cheney, stressed the importance of this investigation being bipartisan.
I have been a conservative Republican since 1984, when I first voted for Ronald Reagan. I've disagreed sharply on policy and politics with almost every Democratic member of this committee. But in the end, we are one nation under God. The framers of our Constitution recognized the danger of the vicious factionalism of partisan politics. And they knew that our daily arguments could become so fierce that we might lose track of our most important obligation to defend the rule of law and the freedom of all Americans. That is why our framers compelled each of us to swear a solemn oath to preserve and protect the Constitution. When a threat to our constitutional order arises, as it has here, we are obligated to rise above politics. This investigation must be nonpartisan. While we begin today by taking the public testimony of these four heroic men, we must also realize that the task of this committee will require persistence. We must issue and enforce subpoenas promptly. We must get to objective truth. We must overcome the many efforts we are already seeing to cover up and obscure the facts. On January 6th, and in the days thereafter, almost all members of my party recognized the events of that day for what they actually were. One Republican, for example, said, quote, "What is happening at the U.S. Capitol right now is unacceptable and un-American. Those participating in lawlessness and violence must be arrested and prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law." No member of Congress should now attempt to defend the indefensible, obstruct this investigation, or whitewash what happened that day. We must act with honor and duty and in the interest of our nation.
Also on the Select Committee, Illinois Republican Representative Adam Kinzinger. He explains why he's serving on the committee.
I never expected a day to be quite as emotional for me as it has been. I've talked to a number of you and gotten to know you. I think it's important to tell you right now, though. You guys may, like, individually feel a little broken. You guys all talk about the effects you have to deal with, and, you know, you talk about the impact of that day. But you guys won. You guys held. You know, democracies are not defined by our bad days. We're defined by how we come back from bad days, how we take accountability for that. And for all the overheated rhetoric surrounding this committee, our mission is very simple. It's to find the truth, and it's to ensure accountability. Like most Americans, I'm frustrated that 6 months after a deadly insurrection breached the United States Capitol for several hours on live television, we still don't know exactly what happened. Why? Because many in my party have treated this as just another partisan fight. It's toxic, and it's a disservice to the officers and their families, to the staff and the employees on the Capitol complex, to the American people who deserve the truth, and to those generations before us who went to war to defend self-governance, because self-governance is at stake. And it's why I agreed to serve on this committee. I want to know what happened that day, but more importantly, I want all Americans to be able to trust the work this committee does and get the facts out there free of conspiracy. This cannot continue to be a partisan fight. I'm a Republican, I'm a conservative. But in order to heal from the damage caused that day, we need to call out the facts. It's time to stop the outrage and the conspiracies that fuel the violence and division in this country. And most importantly, we need to reject those that promote it.
Meanwhile, in a press conference before the hearing, some House Republicans blamed House Speaker Nancy Pelosi for the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Here's New York Republican Elise Stefanik.
There is a reason that Nancy Pelosi is the most disliked elected official in America. She always puts her own partisan politics over what's best for the American people. She's an authoritarian who has broken the people's house. She is a lame duck speaker, and everyone knows it. The reason why Nancy Pelosi is refusing to seat accomplished and well-respected hardworking Republicans like Jim Jordan and Jim Banks is because she doesn't want the American people to know the truth or learn the facts. She doesn't want a fair or bipartisan investigation. She wants a political one. It is a fact that in December of 2020, Nancy Pelosi was made aware of potential security threats to the Capitol, and she failed to act. It is a fact that the U.S. Capitol Police raised concerns, and rather than providing them with the support and resources they needed and they deserved, she prioritized her partisan political optics over their safety. The American people deserve to know the truth that Nancy Pelosi bears responsibility as Speaker of the House for the tragedy that occurred on January 6th. And it was only after Republicans started asking these important questions that she refused to seat them. House Republicans will continue to follow the truth and the facts and support our law enforcement officers to make sure this never happens again in the U.S. Capitol, the People's House. And I'm proud to turn it over to my colleague, very well-respected member, Jim Banks.
At the same press conference, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy responded to a question from a reporter about who's to blame for the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol.
A week after the insurrection, direction, you said that Trump was partially responsible for what happened. Do you still stand by that?
I think from a standpoint, I'm looking at all the investigation as we go forward. I would have liked response faster. Having known what I know today, that you just listened to Rodney Davis, why would a sergeant of arms, when you have an insurrection going on or protest out here, you got a line being broken, and you're the sergeant of arms, why would your first response be, I got to send a note to the speaker to see if it's okay if I can do my job to protect the men and women on the line? Why would that be your first reaction? Why? I don't think any of us knew that. Do you realize that the sergeant of arms, as being a ranking, being the leader of the Republicans, never talked to me prior coming up to the 16th, even though they knew on December 14th? How many meetings did they have with the speaker's office for the preparation? He never passed me a note that day. I would tell you, bring the National Guard. There are people out there who say there were phone calls to the speaker that offered the National Guard prior to that day and was turned down. And being turned down, and you have to ask the speaker on the day of what was going on? Why wouldn't you do your job? Why would you feel that in your job you couldn't make the decision?
A medieval battle. Officers reveal horrors they face defending Capitol on January 6th. That's the headline from Politico.com by congressional reporter Nicholas Wu. As you were there in the room, describe the mood.
It was a really somber mood in the room. I mean, all of the lawmakers had been there on the 6th, as did, frankly, many of the other staff and reporters that were in the room. So as these police officers detailed the experiences they went through, you could see the emotion in a lot of lawmakers' faces as they saw this. And several of the officers got quite emotional as they described their experiences. And at least one even teared up a bit as he gave his remarks. So this was really quite a sobering experience on the Hill this morning.
Now, those four police officers who defended the Capitol during the January 6th riot, this was part of an investigation. Is there an indication that there was any new information that came out of this hearing today?
The interesting thing was that most of these officers had already been fairly vocal about their experiences so far. You know, they'd been on TV, they'd given interviews with newspapers and so on. But the new information, if anything, here was just seeing all four of these officers in the same room being able to talk about their experiences, which was an incredibly powerful thing. One officer, for example, Harry Dunn, a Capitol Police officer, talked about the experience of having racial slurs hurled at him as he responded to the riot and how that felt for him as a Black man.
In your article here that you can find on Politico.com, you described a medieval battle. Talk to us about that.
So interspersed with the witnesses' testimony, lawmakers played video clips from the insurrection. And so people could actually see what these officers were talking about. And this was in close quarters combat, basically, during the insurrection, as you had police officers squaring off in the tunnels around the Capitol against rioters, people fighting back riders with shields, officers getting beaten and sprayed with all manner of things. And in one particular gripping moment, the body camera footage from Officer Mike Fanone, a D.C. police officer who'd been tased during the riot and electrocuted with his own taser. And so that was played. And you can hear him pleading with people partway through it, as they're beating him, you hear him saying that, you know, I have a family, I have kids, you know, please stop. And that was, you know, an incredibly impactful moment for the committee to show today.
Now, in the article at Politico.com by Nicholas Wu, congressional reporter, you write, most House Republicans have shunned participation in the committee, tried to counter-program the hearing instead. That was before the hearing. And now, what do you think the reaction will be after the hearing?
The reaction among a lot of Republicans so far was that they didn't watch it or didn't tune in or were otherwise busy. And what the message Republicans are trying to push instead is that this is some kind of heavy-handed move by Speaker Pelosi to shut Republicans out of the committee.
And in that vein, we heard from Representative Elise Stefanik, a Republican of New York, saying that there is information that Speaker Nancy Pelosi had information that did not protect the Capitol but failed to act. What do we hear about that?
So far, no direct evidence has emerged that the Speaker in any way concealed information about the attack or did not necessarily take proper precautions. And all of that still, beats around the bush of the central question of the insurrection, which is, you know, why were all these people there outside the Capitol and outside the White House in the first place? And that wasn't because they were Pelosi supporters. It was because many of these people were there in an effort to try to overturn the election results.
A medieval battle, officers reveal horrors they faced defending Capitol on January 6th. That article from Politico.com by Nicholas Wu, congressional reporter. Thank you for joining us.
And thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today for Tuesday, July 27th, 2021. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention just revised its guidance on wearing masks. In a reversal of its earlier position, the CDC now recommends that some fully vaccinated people wear masks indoors if they live in areas with significant or high spread. This move comes as the more highly transmissible Delta variant of the coronavirus has led to a surge in infections. Here's CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky with more information.
First, we continue to strongly encourage everyone to get vaccinated. Getting vaccinated continues to prevent severe illness, hospitalization, and death, even with Delta. It also helps reduce the spread of the virus in our communities. Vaccinated individuals continue to represent a very small amount of transmission occurring around the country. We continue to estimate that the risk of a breakthrough infection with symptoms upon exposure to the Delta variant is reduced by sevenfold. The reduction is 20-fold for hospitalizations and deaths. As CDC has recommended for months, unvaccinated individuals should get vaccinated and continue masking until they are fully vaccinated. In areas with substantial and high transmission, CDC recommends fully vaccinated people wear masks in public indoor settings to help prevent the spread of the Delta variant and protect others. This includes schools. CDC recommends that everyone in K-12 schools wear a mask indoors, including teachers, staff, students, and visitors, regardless of vaccination status. Children should return to full-time in-person learning in the fall with proper prevention strategies in place. Finally, CDC recommends community leaders encourage vaccination and universal masking to prevent further outbreaks in areas of substantial and high transmission. With the Delta variant, vaccinating more Americans now is more urgent than ever.
After the CDC director's remarks, President Biden released a statement saying, quote, "On Thursday, I will lay out the next steps in our effort to get more Americans vaccinated. Vaccinations are free, safe, and effective to every American. They've been available to every adult in this country for more than 3 months at locations within 5 miles of 90% of the U.S. population. By following the science and by doing our part by getting vaccinated, America can beat COVID. In the meantime, more vaccinations and mask wearing in the areas most impacted by the Delta variant will enable us to avoid the kind of lockdowns, shutdowns, school closures, and disruptions we faced in 2020. Unlike 2020, we have both the scientific knowledge and the tools to prevent the spread of this disease. We are not going back to that," end quote. You can find the full statement at whitehouse.gov. Senators and the White House were locked in negotiations today to salvage a bipartisan infrastructure deal. That's with pressure mounting on all sides to wrap up talks and show progress on President Joe Biden's top priority. Despite weeks of closed-door discussions, senators from the bipartisan group blew past the Monday deadline set for agreement on the nearly $1 trillion package. The senators hit serious roadblocks over how much would be spent on public transit and water infrastructure and whether the new spending on roads, bridges, broadband, and other projects would be required to meet federal wage requirements for workers. They're also at odds over drawing on COVID-19 funds to help pay for it. Here's Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer Democrat of New York.
On infrastructure, we're making good progress on both tracks. The bipartisan infrastructure bill and the budget resolution with reconciliation instructions. We had a good discussion at lunch. We're doing all we can as a caucus to quickly achieve both tracks. If an agreement can be reached, and I'm very optimistic and hopeful it will be, senators should prepare to work through the weekend in order to finish the bipartisan infrastructure bill. As I've said from the beginning, we got a lot of work to do, but it's my intention to get both the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the budget resolution in the Senate passed before the conclusion of the work period.
In response, we now hear from Iowa Republican Senator Joni Ernst.
President Biden's political advisor is now very, very concerned about inflation. And the demographic that it's hitting the hardest, those that are the most concerned right now, are women. The price of goods and services for nearly everything has gone up because of Bidenomics. And with this $3.5 trillion package, what do we see? We see middle America being hit the hardest with the inclusion of things like the Green New Deal and with new taxes on our farmers and ranchers and small businesses. This has got to stop. Middle Americans are the ones that are paying for Bidenomics. We simply can't afford $3.5 trillion. And folks, I think that's a low estimate for what the Democrats want to pass. They need to stop this reckless tax and spending spree. And I do hope that there are some common sense Democrats that will put an end to this.
The White House wants a bipartisan agreement for this first phase before Democrats go it alone to tackle broader priorities in a bigger $3.5 trillion budget plan that's on deck. Finally today, former Senator Mike Enzi died Monday after being hospitalized from a bicycle accident. He was 77. The Wyoming Republican who retired from the Senate at the end of last year, quote, passed away peacefully today, surrounded by his family. That's according to a message posted to his official Twitter account late Monday night, Wyoming time. Here's a portion of his farewell address from the Senate floor last December.
And I've covered a lot of ground, but for my last piece of advice, I would call on my colleagues to recognize that it's time to formally allow electronics on the floor of the United States Senate. It's an issue near and dear to my heart, and one I think will help to work in the Senate. It's clear that anyone who watches C-SPAN that all of us are already breaking the spirit of the law, checking our phones on occasion as we walk off or onto the floor. Those devices are often inseparable from our ability to do our work. We rely on them to do almost everything. It's time to make this common sense change, allowing iPads to be used for speeches as long as they're laid on the lectern, like a paper speech. And if senators could do some work from their desks, like early senators had to do, we would listen to more of the speeches and get something done. I do remember when I brought that one up before that it was covered by, in 97, they thought it was important that we have that use, and Time Magazine did a special article on it, and I remember Senator McConnell going to New York City and coming back to report to me that he got in a cab, and the cab driver said, "You're a United States Senator, aren't you?" And, of course, he probably was. And the guy said, "So when are you going to let the guy from Wyoming have his computer on the floor?" So Senator McConnell told me if I'd lobbied it down to cabbies that it was time to do it, but we still haven't done it. As we move forward, of course, our country has no shortage of problems we need to address. Some are out of our control, but many are of our own making. If my experience over the years has taught me anything, it's that we'll never be able to tackle these challenges unless we find common areas of agreement first and work to solve these problems together. I hope everyone listening, especially my colleagues in the Senate, remember the core values I spoke of today. Do what's right, do your best, treat others as they wish to be treated. I truly believe that if we adhere to these ideals, the world would be a better place for our children and grandchildren.
Enzi served four terms in the Senate before retiring in 2020 as chairman of the Budget Committee. He was replaced by former Wyoming Republican Representative Cynthia Loomis. A reminder that all of our coverage is online anytime at cspan.org. And if you missed any of this program, you can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Nkoyo Iyamba in Washington, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.